Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the Weekly Pulse podcast. I'm Jeff Snyder, founder and CEO of the Morning Pulse, and your host for the next 60-plus minutes as we go around the globe to discuss the issues related to retirement, the markets, technology, personal finance, and so much more. We've got a great show, and as I said last week, we're going to be joined ongoing by Mr. Grant Sabatier. He is the creator and founder of Millennial Money, so look for that in this great episode. And our special guest this week, Ms. Angela Antonelli. She's the executive director of the Georgetown Center for Retirement Initiatives. We'll check in with Angela. She's a friend of the show, and we'll see what's going on at Georgetown and what are some of the key initiatives that are going on around Washington, D.C. and this country to help people retire and save. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this great episode of The Weekly Pulse. We're going to kick things off, as we always do on the show, with a look at tech and social media trends. And joining me now from California is the senior finance editor for LinkedIn, Mr. Devin Banerjee. Hey, Devin, how are you, bud?
I'm doing great, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing great. Did you have a good week?
I did, yeah.
Good. Lots of stuff going on. The market's very volatile. I'm sure there were plenty of discussions on LinkedIn, Marriott data breaches. I mean, this is a panoply of news. For you at the folks at LinkedIn, and especially on the finance aspect of the site, what's top of mind for you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll let some of your later smarter guests talk about what's happening in the markets. But across social media, some really good conversations on some finance issues this week. The one I have to mention is this blockbuster story that actually came out of Bloomberg, but we highlighted it on our platform, and I think a lot of people did on other social media. It was about how people on Wall Street are trying to sidestep the Me Too movement with some really kind of strange informal policies. So the reporters at Bloomberg found that men on Wall Street are starting to avoid one-on-one meetings with women, avoid work trips with women. One person they quoted even said that he thinks that hiring women is a risk now because they might they might take something the wrong way. So a really dangerous trend, and as you can imagine, it just lit up social media with people weighing in on how this is a really dangerous, as I said, step back for women who are candidly looking for mentors, both men and women in the industry to help them progress. And these kinds of informal policies that are cropping up in banks and hedge funds at private equity firms are really, I think, a step back for an industry that thrives on mentorship. And so, again, as you can imagine, some really strong comments around this issue on social media, but definitely a story worth checking out. Again, that came out of Bloomberg earlier this week.
Yeah, very interesting story, and I agree. I mean, there's no sense isolating yourself. I mean, we just have to figure out how to have conversations with each other and do it appropriately. Seems easy enough, I guess, if you look at it on face value, but I can understand some of the trepidation that people feel, but sounds to me, just without even having read the story, an overreaction. And also, I'm not an attorney, but it would seem to put you in a bad situation should you get caught up in some type of legal endeavor. So can we all just help each other out? Seems the way I would kind of phrase it, but who am I? I'm just a podcast host.
No, I mean, there's one guy the Bloomberg reporters quoted who said it's really simple. Just don't be an a-hole, you know, like and so, as you said, you know, sometimes you can understand trepidation, and, you know, all of us can understand women's concerns about these policies. But at the end of the day, like you said, we just have to learn how to speak to each other and interact with each other as professionals and adults. So hopefully we see this change, and I think the story brought a lot of awareness to this issue.
Absolutely.
Another interesting conversation we saw on our platform this week, and you and I have talked about this in the past, which is jobs that, you know, down the line may be at risk of disappearing due to automation or due to AI. So A new report out this week found that some of the jobs most at risk, so I'll just list off some of these, parking enforcement workers. So perhaps that's because of this this autonomous vehicle trend that we see coming around the corner. Word processors, typists, watch repairers, for some reason, interestingly enough. Let's see, computer operators, telephone operators. So as you can see, a lot of these, you know, potentially at threat by AI and automation. At the same time, we saw another interesting conversation crop up on social media about how global unemployment, so around the globe, has actually fallen to its lowest level in four decades. So this analysis from UBS found that, you know, worldwide unemployment is down to 5.2%. That's down from 8% just in 2010. And this 5.2% rate is the lowest, as I mentioned, since 1980. We see some economists like Charles Robertson weighing in, saying that these low unemployment figures are actually proof to him, and they counter this idea that robots are taking our jobs. And so there's this interesting dichotomy where we're also worried about what jobs could be lost to AI and automation, but we're actually not seeing it. You know, it's not being borne out in any of the numbers yet. And so perhaps there's this middle ground that some people talk about, which is technology will just supplement and help us in all of our jobs and actually not replace us in large amounts.
Tell me, Devin, did you see anywhere on the list podcast host or investment consultant advisor? Were they listed?
They were not listed, so no need to worry. You can sleep well this weekend.
Well, just this weekend. Well, I would say to you, in all seriousness, I think, and just like the retirement discussion, I think it's about trying to continually better yourself. Whether you are doing word processing today, how can you improve your skills? I think you've got to have that mindset. Just like I don't think retirement, you know, really seeing retirement being redefined. Retirement isn't sitting on the porch with your grandkids or playing tennis or golf. It's still being productive. And I think, you know, how you get over that fear is knowing that you're continuing to evolve yourself as a person, as a professional, and learning. And if I think you had that mindset, it kind of counters that fear, just my personal opinion.
No, absolutely. And we hear companies all the time talk about this, their focus on continual education, on skills, learning and education throughout people's career. So it's not like you just go to school or get a graduate degree and do some training and suddenly you have all the skills you need for the next 40, 50 years, you know? So, I think companies are really embracing this trend of continual learning. The last thing I'll mention this week, just to end on a light note, because we saw a lot of cool conversation around this, a report from Harvard, a Harvard researcher, found that complimenting yourself and celebrating your victories, even the small ones, can have a powerful effect on your mood and your productivity, your ability to accomplish even bigger things going forward. So how can you get started? This researcher, Teresa Amabile, says, make a habit of regularly listing your accomplishments, reflecting on your accomplishments, big ones and small ones. And this practice can actually come in handy and help you during performance reviews or job interviews. But in the meantime, it will lift your mood and lift your ability to accomplish things every day.
Yeah, I think it's just positive. I don't think you have to go out there and beat your chest like Tarzan and right. say you're the greatest thing since sliced bread. I think it's acknowledging that life is a journey, and there are little incremental changes as well as big changes. And you got to – my wife tells me this all the time. I've got to take a look in the short run. You can't always, you know, look at things over a 12-month or 24-month period. You've got to really take it and note all the great things that you've done, and some of them small, some of them big. Get those singles, doubles, triples, home runs, and base on balls, and that's how you play the game of life.
Yeah, very well said. I agree.
Well, yeah. Hey, look, I'm being very, very prolific today. It's amazing. We'll see how it goes the rest of the show. But Devin, always a pleasure talking to you. Love to hear the user sentiments on LinkedIn, and appreciate you spending a few minutes with us. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. Take care.
Bye, bud. Welcome back, and now we're going to be talking a little tech, or a lot of tech, depending on the news. Joining me now, she is a tech reporter for The Motley Fool. Please welcome to the show, Ms. Natalie Walters. Hey, Nat, how are you?
Hey, you're doing great. You?
Yeah, I'm doing okay. It's a little chilly here in New York, as you know, and it's not good when you don't have a lot of hair. So I'm doing okay, but I'm doing okay.
Yeah, I actually recently got a very short haircut, so I'm honestly in the same boat with you right now.
Yeah, it's a little challenging, but you know, that's where knit caps and scarves come into place. And after all, we're in the Northeast in New York, so it will be cold during this time of year. But a lot of interesting things going on in the tech world, and I know you want to bring us up to speed on what you're following and what you're covering.
Yeah, so a big story this week was that the ride-hailing company Lyft filed for an IPO, and that's interesting because it's coming ahead of Uber's IPO. And so when Lyft does have its IPO, and that could be as early as the first quarter of 2019, investors are going to be watching it closely to see how it does. And, you know, if it does well, then Uber is probably going to do even better because it's a bigger company. Or if it does poorly, then you know, Uber might want to wait a little bit longer, but Uber does have in its clause with one of its investors that it has to file for an IPO before next September. So either way, it'll be after Lyft, soon after Lyft, but it'll be an interesting sort of experiment to see how the market reacts to Lyft, because I think that there's been so much anticipation of people waiting for either Lyft or Uber to have one. So I think it'll be nice to finally see what happens and, you know, how successful it is or not.
Yeah, I wonder if there's precedent for companies that do similar things like Lyft and Uber that have staggered their IPOs in the past. I got to think that, and I don't know if I'm not, I don't mean to put you on the spot. I'm just wondering if there's a precedent, you know, there's something that's happened in the past when this has occurred to kind of give us an idea of which way the market would go. Because if people are buying, you know, does the timing of Lyft versus Uber have an impact on the market? What kind of impact would it have on the market, I guess? I don't know.
Right. I think it's, you know, it kind of depends on how closely they follow each other. You know, if Lyft comes out first and does well, and then Uber comes out later that year, I think Uber will do well too, and even better. But, you know, if Lyft comes out in early 2019 and, you know, hit the high, and then it does poorly the rest of the year and kind of drops off, then, like, I don't think Uber will have as good of an IPO. You know, I think it'll just depend on the timing and how close together they are. You know, if you look at, like, Snapchat, that was, you know, this cool new millennial company, and maybe it had an IPO close to, you know, say Facebook or something, you know, if it was around then, it probably would have done well, but it came out, you know, so far after Facebook, and people already saw that Facebook and Instagram were doing better than Snapchat. And so, you know, Snap's performance after its IPO was just not good.
Yeah. Well, I guess more to come on that. It's, you know, we're not going to predict the future on this show, but, really interesting. I'm very happy that there are initial public offerings. It's obviously a good sign. You want that to happen.
Yeah.
You want companies to be created and get investors. So good sign.
And it seems like, you know, it's interesting to look at the differences between Lyft and Uber, because it seems like for a while nobody was really paying attention to Lyft, you know, and Uber was the obvious winner. And then Uber had so many scandals, and, you know, people started seeing it in a different light, and people started using Lyft more, and then Lyft grabbed hold of that perception and started saying, you know, using sort of the motto, you know, we treat our drivers better, and, you know, we're just a nicer company, and really use that to their advantage. So Lyft is not as big as Uber, but it's growing faster than Uber.
Yeah.
But it's also losing money quickly. So yeah, it'll be interesting to watch that.
Absolutely. What else is going on? I know. I don't know if you're planning to cover any of the data breaches that occurred. It seems like there's one every day. But what else is on your plate? I'm sorry. I don't mean to say. I'm not trying to tee it up for you. I'm just asking you. You know, what else is on your mind?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that was a great, perfect setup because Facebook continues to be in the news, and there were some internal emails that came out this week and showed once again that Facebook maybe is not the most transparent company. And those emails show that Facebook, basically since it was created, has always put its own success and its own money above anything else and any other company and just anything else that has been the forefront of what they do. And their internal email showed that they specifically turned off a feature on the Vine app that allowed people to follow their Facebook friends on the Vine app. And then a year later, Vine shut down. So just things like that. And I think it's just along the same trend we've been talking about, where people had such a high, dreamy view of tech companies, you know, for a while there after Facebook was created, and everyone thought they were the greatest thing. And so, you know, they were just focusing on connecting people and helping people. And now that's truly been shattered, and it continues to be shattered. And people's trust in them is just is pretty non-existent, I'd say, right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just a warning sign. I think, you know, our industry, the retirement industry, is starting to use a lot of data. Data has become a big issue. Cybersecurity is a huge issue. Will continue to be a huge issue from now and probably till the end of time. But, you know, I think customers are more and more weary of giving up their information. And actually, I was thinking about this on the drive home from the gym this morning. You know, I use an Apple iPhone. I have a Roku and Amazon Fire. I use Google a lot. You know, I guess it depends. I guess I'm spreading out the wealth of who I'm giving my information to, I guess, basically, right? Because I'm not giving, you know, I'm not just using all Amazon. I'm not just using all Apple. I'm not just using all Google or Firefox. So right. I think, you know, I'm trying to be generous and spread the wealth.
Not put all your eggs in one basket.
Why give everyone the data? Why give everyone the data? Natalie, I certainly appreciate your insight and a lot of great stories. I mean, I think this one just keeps on giving as we're going to be talking about this one from 2018 and beyond. So good work as usual, and have a wonderful weekend, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks so much. Sounds great.
Thanks, Nat.
See you next week.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Welcome back, everyone. And now it's time for our markets segment. Joining me on the phone, on the show, are Kevin Kelly. He is a principal with Delphi Digital and the product manager for StockTwits, Mr. Michael Bozzello. Hey, guys, how are you?
Doing great, Jeff.
Hey, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing well. And I think we should just start off by wishing Michael a very happy birthday. I don't want to get into, you know, I hope you have a great weekend. Today is Michael's birthday, so we hope that he and his family have a lot of good times.
Happy birthday, Michael.
Thanks, guys. Good to be here.
Yep. I know the audience is going to send all their gifts to you, so I'm just kidding there. We don't want to violate any FINRA or compliance rules. Okay, so I've really taken us out on a limb, but Kevin, I want to come to you. We've had a volatile week, obviously, in the market. Things continue to go up and down, mainly down. Got some interesting job numbers, some job creation numbers. Can you just break down what's happening in the market this week?
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, from a kind of a technical perspective, there's been a few kind of indicators that have triggered that's led to some selling pressure, at least the last few days. One of which being the kind of infamous death cross, where you have the 50-day moving average for an index or a stock crossing below its 200-day. And you're seeing that. You saw that, you know, this morning, today in the S&P 500. So definitely a little selling pressure there. The jobs numbers, as you mentioned, came out this morning. I mean, what I've really been kind of watching for, and again, you don't want to take any jobs number really in isolation, but over time, what that trend looks like. And so, yes, I mean, the argument the kind of rolling average of adding, you know, between 150 to 200,000 jobs, you know, every month sounds like it's great for the labor force, great for, you know, potentially economic growth. But I think what, you know, you're really starting to kind of see here is, you know, the concerns really come to the forefront of the market, you know, that this growth can actually continue. How much slack really is there left in the labor market, you know, before we really start to get those inflationary pressures pushing higher? You had, you know, a decent wage print today. So I think those are kind of the things the market's looking for. And then if you take a more kind of international perspective, you know, I think 2018 is going to go down in history as a very kind of unusual type year, just based on some of the volatility, especially kind of to end the year here. But when you look out 2019, you know, the U.S. has been so dominant the last couple of years, you know, or at least I should say for 2018, you know, I'm not sure that potentially continues next year, just given some of the earnings trends, the analyst outlooks, you know, for growth here. You're coming off this big, again, you know, tax cut that gave a big boost in 2018 here domestically. I think you may potentially start to see, you know, a reversal into, you know, some of these more emerging market stocks that have really gotten beaten down, especially as, you know, you kind of hit this peak earnings cycle here within the U.S. equity market. So this week's been definitely a volatile one, but I don't think that really that's really going to subside as we head into Christmas.
Yeah, really unfortunate. Michael, StockTwits is one of the largest investor platforms, social media platforms. What's the sentiment? What has the sentiment been this past week and the week before, given some of the volatility, the downturn in the market, some of the market events? What's the rapid reaction you're getting?
So forgive me, guys, the water's coming on in our office and the heat gets really loud here.
No worries.
But I'll actually spring off of what Kevin said about sort of an unusual end to the year. And that is really showing on our platform with the different chatter we're seeing. So just to put into perspective for you guys, the SPY stream, which is sort of our benchmark for all things political, the overall health of the market, investor sentiment, we're doing about 8,000 messages a day on the SPY stream. If you compare that to the year-to-date average is about 2,500 messages. Mm-hmm. And if you go back to this time last year in December, we were only doing about 1,500 messages. So it's a very unusual end to the year, and people are really talking. And I think the volatility, the tariffs, jobs, you just combine this all, and it is sort of an unusual end to the year that looks like it's going to go right into 2019.
Yeah, Kevin, any thoughts on that? I mean, I love the fact how you benchmark. You know, obviously, traditionally, people benchmark with returns, but you're actually kind of doing some benchmarking using investor sentiment and messaging, which I think is really cool. But Kevin, any rapid reaction to that?
It's actually really interesting, especially when you think about where we were this time last year. I mean, you really had, I would say January of 2018 was really when you started to hit, you know, more of the parabolic, price action within, you know, the equity markets, not only here, you know, domestically in the S&P 500, but also in, you know, emerging markets and such. So that is actually a really interesting stat. I'd be really curious, you know, as we go on, we'd love to hear, you know, as we get into January and we see if this volatility either subsides or continues, you know, kind of what the year-over-year comparisons are there in terms of some of the stats you just mentioned, because those actually really jumped out to me. I didn't know it was kind of that drastic of a difference.
Yeah, I actually wasn't expecting that either. I actually pulled this data earlier for I had an interview with Bloomberg, so I was glad that, you know, I got to get on the show today and share this. But just to jump into some of the sentiment stuff here, this is also really interesting too. So obviously Trump's China tariffs, that's all top of mind right now. So what we did, we had our data team look at mentions of Trump tariffs or China across their entire platform from September, which is when we had that first, you know, announcement of tariffs to recently Monday when we had the most recent truce. And so for those, we've done 150,000 total messages. On September 17th, when people use those terms, we saw a 20% increase in bullishness associated with those terms. So, okay, the market's at new all-time highs in September. You would think, you know, every all news is good news at that point. Now we're in this volatile downturn market, and we looked at the same mentions of those words on Monday, and we also saw a 20% increase in bullishness around those terms. So that, to me, really stood out, too, when you have two different types of markets, but the way investors are speaking about those words are still the same.
Yeah, absolutely. Really interesting. Kevin, in the remaining time, we've got about 2 minutes left. Let's talk a little crypto What's, you know, Bitcoin, is it the rush to the bottom? Can you give us a, you know, I don't want to just pick on them, but I mean, you know, what's going on with crypto?
I'd love to say that the bleeding stops at the equity market, but it certainly doesn't. No, I mean, crypto prices have gotten really hit. I think you mentioned last week or a couple of weeks ago, we've seen this most recent selling pressure. We kind of broke it out by, you know, long-term holders versus some people that are more speculative who've gotten the market, you know, recently. It's definitely, we've seen this selling pressure come from some of the longer term holders, which is concerning to some to a degree, but I think that's kind of necessary for us to get a real kind of capitulation here and actually hit a price bottom. So long story short, we ran some quick analysis. We're actually coming out with a report next week, so we won't spoil it too much, but as a little bit of a sneak peek, we're actually going to be probably calling for a bottom in Bitcoin and maybe not general crypto prices, but really Bitcoin heading into Q1, probably midway to the latter half of Q1 in 2019, just based on a number of factors that we've been seeing, one of which being the most recent kind of price acceleration, or I should say acceleration in downward price movement of that downward trend in Bitcoin. So still very interesting. You know, it's not, again, nothing's financial advice, but you know, my mom's been asking me, for example, when she can invest in the things that I'm looking at, and I told her to kind of stay on the sidelines at least for now, at least through the end of the year. So.
Well, that's always good advice, especially to folks who may not be as sophisticated investors as with these types of instruments. Michael, just to kind of close out, any sentiment that you're picking up on in the crypto markets from
So,
your social network?
for sure. So I'll just give a little before and after. So 2017, I've never seen the amount of influx in new users to the platform since I've been at StockTwits. This irrational exuberance. 15% of our daily messages and overall messages were made up of crypto at that time. Now we're down to around about 3 to 5%, depending on the day. You know, big days like this, closer to 5%. So it's just amazing to me. And I think 2017 holidays versus 2018 holidays with your family, the discussions around crypto are going to look very different, and people are discussing that right on our stream. So it's pretty wild.
Well, great. Guys, thank you so much. Appreciate all your insight and information. I think it's really helpful to the audience, kind of give them a picture. Wish you guys the best weekend. Michael, have a great birthday, and you have my permission to extend the party all next week, and we'll talk to you in a few weeks.
I love it. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks. Take care,
Thanks,
guys.
guys.
Bye. Welcome back, everyone. And we've got a great guest. She's a recurring guest on our show. Very pleased to be joined by the Executive Director for the Georgetown University Center for Retirement Initiatives, Ms. Angela Antonelli. Hi, Angela.
Hi, Jeff. How are you? I hope you had a happy Thanksgiving.
I did. How was your Thanksgiving?
I managed to get a little bit of rest, which was nice.
I know. Well, you and your team at Georgetown CRI, Center for Retirement Initiatives, have been exceedingly busy. There's a lot going on, and I wanted to just check in with you, if I might, to see all the great stuff that you guys are working on. I'm looking at the website now. Treasurer Tobias Reed from Oregon did a blog. You write a lot of pieces for Dow Jones MarketWatch, and had a great piece on women and retirement. So I don't know where you want to start, but I'll leave that to you. But there's great stuff going on at the CRI. So what do you want to start with?
Yeah, so I'd say right now, probably we're really focused on what's exciting in the latest developments and what's happening in the states and the state retirement initiatives. I think in your podcasts, as you often touch upon them, and you did in your last podcast, and John Scott from Pew, you had John Scott from Pew on. There's great things happening with the launch of programs in a number of states. And, you know, most recently what we've seen was the launch in Illinois of their auto IRA program. California this week had a five-city tour that was done by Katie Zielinski and Treasurer John Chung, going around the state, excited about the launch of the new pilot of CalSAVERS that will start in January. They'll be enrolling, I think, somewhere upwards of 20 employers and a pilot, over 2,000 employees, to get things started in January of 2019. And as many know, and as you mentioned, Tobias Reed, Treasurer of Oregon, has been out front with the implementation of Oregon Saves, which has been going very, very well in Oregon. So, you know, those programs are the first three to actually be enrolling workers as we go into January of 2019. A number of other states are in the process of setting their programs up to get ready to launch. So the developments are exciting. It's exciting to see thousands of workers starting to save who weren't saving before. And we really want to highlight the success in Oregon and elsewhere. And so Treasurer Reed was kind enough to contribute a blog post talking about just the phenomenal success of the program to date, with, you know, the continuing to enroll the workers, the growth in assets, more than a million a month. And I think the latest notice as of the end of November is they're just about at the $10 million mark. So again, you know, tremendous success with what we're seeing in Oregon, with the continued exponential growth of workers that are saving and the assets that are being managed in the program. So it's all very exciting.
Yeah, great leadership by the states. And the federal government actually stepped up, and I don't say that facetiously, they stepped up and they have a proposal out for multiple employer plans. So there's a lot of different solutions, and every state's unique. I know you know the folks at Vermont have a different approach than the folks in Illinois and Oregon and California. So really great to see people all over this country stepping up.
So, yeah, I mean, we the great success with Oregon, and, you know, on December 13th, the center is going to be hosting a webinar with California, Illinois, and Oregon to have them share the stories of the progress with those programs. So I would encourage your listeners, if they're interested, to go to our website and to register for that webinar on December 13th at 2 o'clock. One of the things, we'll also have Lou Minsky, who's the president and CEO of the Defined Contribution Institutional Investment Association. And DCIA, along with Pensions and Investments, recently gave an Excellence in Innovation Award to Oregon for the creation of the Oregon Saves program. You know, I think it's important. You know, there are some folks who may be, you know, somewhat skeptical or even critical of these state public-private partnerships, but I think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, when we're dealing with closing the access gap in retirement savings, it's really a combination of efforts of both the private sector, but also these state public-private partnerships. The state public-private partnerships are really filling a need that the private sector has not been able to meet. And, you know, the great success and the measure of success of these state programs actually is, I would argue, different than what private sector usually measures as success, which is assets under management. But really with these state programs, the measures of success for these programs is what they're doing to reach low and moderate income workers and small businesses, and getting, you know, providing these workers who, again, do not have easy access to low-cost ways to save, to give them that opportunity to save, and they are beginning to save. And so, you know, that combination of what has been, you know, private sector efforts combined with these state public-private partnerships, you know, what we will see is, again, what we hope to be seeing is the closing of that access gap over time. So the webinar will highlight some of that and, you know, the award to Oregon, which I think is a significant recognition of what these state public-private partnerships have to offer. And then also the center is going to be hosting a meeting of states at Brown University on December 11th, and we're bringing states together to think about, as we see more and more states setting up these programs. We now have 10 states and one city, but I think we need to continue the discussion, because, as you know, for smaller states with smaller populations, it's a little bit more difficult in terms of getting to those economies of scale, mm-hmm. and and keeping costs as low as possible. So we're going to be exploring, and we have a working paper on our website about looking at multi-state arrangements and collaborative arrangements across states. So again, ways that states might be able to work together in the context of these retirement savings initiatives to, again, be able to more effectively achieve economies of scale and spread those startup and ongoing costs. And we look at models in the College 529 space, and more recently the ABLE savings programs, both state savings programs. So again, states have experiences in multiple program areas with these types of state savings programs. And we already see these kinds of collaborative arrangements that are out there. So, you know, we're going to facilitate a dialogue, you know, as we look forward in other ways, similar to what we see in these other programs. Could it also apply in the retirement space? Could there be ways for states to begin to come together to collaborate and establish and work together for these retirement savings programs as well? So we do have a lot going on the space.
Yeah, absolutely. And congratulations on the fostering of collaboration. I love that. That's a great I love that word, collaboration. And I think seeing people work together and leveraging what has been done in other areas like the ABLE 529 plans, it's amazing. You also are a author, and you wrote a piece you write pieces all the time for Dow Jones Market Watch, but you actually explored challenges women face when planning for retirement. Anything you can share from that article that you learned as you were writing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reality is that too often we forget when we're thinking about the retirement savings challenge that there are some things about, you know, about life that can be a little bit different with respect to sort of where the burdens tend to fall or where the disruptions tend to fall. And, you know, for women, there are a number of different situations in life where they could find themselves a little bit more on the short end of the stick when it comes to the opportunities to consistently save for retirement. You know, not surprisingly, you know, one of the big issues today that is happening, and we talk about retirement and the aging of the population, is caregiving. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, increasingly more and more, you know, baby boomers. I've faced that along with many people that I know, you know, often called the sandwich generation, because you're dealing with kids as well as taking care of elderly parents. And that elderly caregiving can take, and often tends more often, women more than men tend to take that burden on for the family and often leave the workforce for some period of time. Obviously, you know, where they lose that income, they lose that and often also stop saving for retirement. There are also issues around, you know, earnings pay gap that you often hear people talk about, and to the extent that women do earn less than men on average and for comparable jobs, you know, obviously lower earnings, less likely to be putting as much away for retirement. More part-time work, sometimes when you look at the data, again, women make up a significant part of the workforce, but they make up even more of the part-time workforce. And again, often as part-time workers, they don't have access to the same types of benefits, and that includes the ability to save for retirement. And then, you know, there's also just, unfortunately, a vulnerability that comes with death of the spouse, and being left on your own. So even women in retirement, often when their spouse passes away, perhaps there isn't that sort of financial planning or even approaching retirement where you have a dual income and you suddenly lose a spouse, can have a major financial shock. So there are different things along the way, obviously, that can contribute to taking away from the ability to really consistently save for retirement over time. That those types of career disruptions tend to affect women more than men, and therefore women are less likely to accumulate as much as they should and what they would need for retirement. We know even today that most elderly unmarried women, a large portion of them rely heavily for Social Security and retirement, and that's today. And if we look to the future, and again, what we have today in terms of retirement savings access and options, you know, the prospects are a little bit daunting in terms of what it means for future generations of savers and for women, unless something changes. And we need to look at making tools available to individuals more consistently, whether they're in the workforce or outside of the workforce. So again, this gets to probably a broader discussion where we talk so much about an employer sponsored retirement system, about ways that we need to really look outside of an employer sponsored system such that individuals really have the tools and the connectedness that's needed in order to, even if you're out of the workforce, and if you can, continue to consistently save for retirement when you do face those disruptions.
Obviously a lot going on. Great analysis, and part of solving a problem is talking about it, and we have a lot of work to do, unfortunately. So, Angela, we'll have to leave it there. Appreciate your contributions, as always, and always great catching up and talking with you. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll talk to you very, very soon.
Thanks, Jeff. Always appreciate the opportunity. Have a great weekend.
You too. Bye. Welcome back, everyone. And this is a brand new segment, but I think it's a really pertinent segment. Very pleased to welcome back to the show. He's the founder, creator of Millennial Money, and I would say he has the pulse on millennials. Let's welcome in Grant back, I should say, to the show, Grant Sabatier. Grant, how are you, buddy?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm doing great. And I think, you know, your segment last week was so impressive. We got really rave reviews. And, you know, millennials are obviously a very big generation of people. People want to know what they're thinking, but there are lessons to be learned across the generations. And so we're excited to have you as a regular contributor. So what's been big for you this week? I mean, just to kind of recap for the audience, Grant's got a book coming out. He's a public speaker. He's been on, had many appearances on television, radio, podcasts, et cetera. He's a very busy man. We're very pleased to have him. What's top of mind for you, Grant?
Yeah, so I think the first thing is this past week, there was some research that came out from a couple of different sources that's really credible, that millennials, relative to the amount of money that they have saved for their age, are significantly behind both Generation X and the baby boomers, significantly behind where they were at this age. So one of the things, it's unfortunate that even though a lot of millennials are saving for retirement, it's very clear based on estimations that about 90%, based on the current levels, won't have enough to retire even by 65. And this biggest reason, obviously, student loan debt and the fact that for a lot of millennials, wages have stagnated. You know, they're just not making enough money relative to the amount of debt that they have. So I spent this past week doing some interviews around that particular topic. And honestly, it makes my mission to help, younger people and millennials specifically become financially independent as quickly as possible. It just strengthens that resolve in me even more.
Yeah.
Just because it just kind of makes me sad, to be honest with you.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sad. I'm sad when people of all generations can't save. But I want every generation to be better than the last. I mean, I think we all do. And I think from my experience, and I want to get your opinion on this, because when I was doing the Roads to Retirement series, or when I do the Roads to Retirement series, and this last one I did in California, I was talking to a particular millennial who came out of school during 2008. So he graduated from college, had an English degree, very smart person, got into the book selling field. And, he was really saying how difficult it was to get a job at that time and then get a high-paying job, and that he may have missed opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, I graduated in 2007, so right about the same time. And, yeah, it was a tough market to get a job in, especially when all the data shows that, you know, your future salary, your lifetime earnings are significantly impacted based on your salary the first 5 years of your career. And so you have to think, if you're not getting paid that much those first 5 years, you know, all data is data, and it's you know, it just points to a trend. But, you know, the simple fact is, you know, most people, when they get jobs and they move to another job, they're getting a 2 to 5%, maybe a 10% pay bump. And so where you're starting from really has a big impact, especially from a salary perspective. And this is one of the things, the unfortunate paradox of kind of the gig economy is that, yes, it's never been easier in history to make money. You know, you can graduate from college and start delivering for Amazon Fresh or driving for Uber. You know, there's so many things you can do. But those gig economy jobs, while they give you flexibility, they you're not able to make as much money as possible because you're really only limited by the hours and the day that you have to work. And you don't get the added benefit of things like benefits of a full-time job. And so in a vast majority of cases, especially your first 10 years of your career, a salary job is going to set you up, especially from a retirement savings standpoint, much, much better than a gig economy job. And that's the tough thing because, you know, I was young and I loved the, you know, having some flexibility, and I get that. But those jobs don't, you know, really support the ability to even make enough money to start saving for retirement. And that's really the big challenge I see with those jobs.
Yeah. You and I have talked several times off camera, off mic, about communicating and educating and, you know, the evolution of those formats to reach people, because, you know, the old way of doing and reaching people to save and to put money away, it's just not, hasn't worked or it's saturated. What's your take on that? Because I know that you want people to save, but people, the record keepers, the people that are in the business, they need to pivot a little bit. They need to engage people in different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the first thing, it's been great that the impact of people like, you know, Professor Richard Thaler at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business and his work on with Cass Sunstein on nudging, you know, the impact that, you know, a lot of people, you want to opt them into something and make it so they have to opt out, not the other way around. And so a lot of that work that they've done over the years has been paying some dividends, just because now of, you know, I would say a majority of retirement plan providers and employers are opting in their employees to save, often at about 3% of their salary. The problem is that's just not enough. Mm-hmm. And that's the paradox here, because it's like, great, it's something. Mm-hmm. It's better than nothing. But is it really moving the needle? Because it's not enough. And so I'd love to see, you know, opt-ins at kind of the 10 or 15% rate, at least at bare minimum. I also think that, and I've been looking, I think a majority of 401k plan providers, and especially employers, you know, they don't really support through both education as well as, like I mentioned, those kind of nudge strategies. They don't support helping employees actually save enough to retire. You know, the education in a lot of those portals is just so basic. You know, it's just along the lines of like, save early and often.
Yeah.
But there's no data around, hey, here's the difference between saving 5% and 40%, for example, of you know, in terms of the implications that it'll have on when you can retire. And that's one of the things that kind of makes me sad, is because, you know, that information is out there. The problem is it's just not being provided to people who would benefit the most from it, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you bring up some great points. And I would say, just to kind of close things out, I want to get your reaction to this. We had the Pension Protection Act and allowed people to have a safe harbor to get them auto-enrolled in the plan. And I think – I agree. I think that was a great thing. I think they need to pop the cap, which means a revisitation of those rules above that, because we know that you need to save more than – especially when you're younger, I mean, the power of compounding, 15 to 20. You know, you need to be in the double digits to save. The second thing that I think is very important that I think often gets lost, and I want to get your reaction to this in the last minute that we have, is – you know, we talk about set it and forget it, but I want people to be engaged. It's not enough to just get people in. Yes, I think they have a lot going on, but we also want to have the corollary to that is we want to have people who take ownership of their personal and professional lives and seek the independence. And that would be just something that I think. It's great to have these nudges. I think the work is tremendous. I think we've made great strides, But we still need, to your point, we need to work hard on engagement and get people learning about financial literacy. I know you're doing a ton of that when you're out on the road and being interviewed, et cetera.
Yeah, I think the another paradox here is that it's not in most employers' best interest to help their employees save as much money as possible. Because when employees save as much money as they can, it increasingly gives them more flexibility and freedom mm-hmm. with which to leave their jobs. You know, and so that's the catch-22 here, where it's like, I really think the responsibility actually falls on the employer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's great examples of employers out there who do a good job of educating. But really, you know, it's like they don't have a whole lot at stake by teaching their employees how to save. Because, you know, I hear this, like some of my friends that have saved enough to leave their jobs, you know, it's switching the power dynamic from the employer to the employee. And that's a precarious position for the employer, as talent is more in demand than ever. You know, employers are kind of walking that fine line of providing just enough benefits and just enough information to keep employers, you know, to keep employees in the job, not necessarily giving them more freedom and flexibility. So, you know, unfortunately, like a lot of things, it falls back then again on the responsibility of the employee and on the consumer to educate themselves and to really take their money and their financial life in their own hands, because something that's so important as money, you know, you really shouldn't be outsourcing that to whether it's your 401k provider or even, you know, other types of professionals. You know, money has the power to literally help you live the exact life that you want. And that's not in a lot of employers' best interest. And so we'll see, man. It's a crazy time, and thankfully we're moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
But, you know, every time one of these reports comes out, it's just like, gosh, we really haven't, you know, in some cases we're moving backwards faster than we're moving forwards.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And I want to unpack those. Maybe next week we can spend some time unpacking some of these surveys some more, because I have a lot of thoughts, and I'm sure you do as well. We're going to have to leave it there. He's the co-founder and creator, or not co-founder, he is the founder of Millennial Money, Grant Sabatier. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. I appreciate it. You too.
Bye. And welcome back. And now it's time for our personal finance section. And, you know, this couldn't be more perfectly timed, what we're going to talk about today. You know, it is the end of the year, time to shop for gifts. And joining me on the line is one half of the MarketWatch mavens, Mr. Jacob Passy. Hey, Jacob, how are you, bud?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
I'm doing great. It's been a good week, a busy week, but I'm doing well. It's a little cold here in New York, as you know, and really bad when you don't have hair. So I'm doing the best I can. How was your week?
Yeah. It was pretty good. My father-in-law was in town, so got to hang out with him, which was nice. And yeah, busy week
good
as
for
usual.
Good for you. So you are writing. You're part of a story series that you're working on at MarketWatch, called "Gifts That Pay Off." And one of the things that you wrote about recently this week is how to buy gift cards for friends and family that won't go to waste. So I'll turn it over to you, but what's the thesis here, and have at it.
Yeah, so gift cards are obviously one of the most popular items to purchase during the holiday season. According to the National Retail Federation, they're the second most popular gift. Around 56% of consumers purchase one this time of year to give to someone else. And, you know, given that, you know, that so many people give gift cards, unfortunately, so many gift cards go unused. Around $1 billion worth of gift cards go unused every year. And, you know, I've definitely been there before. You know, I've received a gift card for a store I never really shopped at, misplaced it, found it years later, you know, that whole trend. So what I took a look at was, you know, different ways to approach giving gift cards, because they are kind of a useful gift to have in your arsenal. You know, it's hard to shop for people, and I completely understand, you know, sometimes it's easier just to give them, you know, you don't want to give them money because that's kind of inelegant. So a gift card is a little bit nicer than that. So I spoke with different shopping experts and kind of got ideas of ways you can give gift cards more smartly. So one of the ways was, you know, to choose gift cards that help your friend or loved one meet a goal. So, you know, we think of gift cards as being for, you know, stores or restaurants, but, you know, a whole range of different types of places accept gift cards. So, you know, Goal Setter, which is a savings and gifting platform where you can open free savings accounts. Mm-hmm. They offer digital gift cards called Goal Cards. So, you know, parents can set up, you know, an account on there to help their kids save for a new bike or something like that, and then you can give a gift card towards that. That's just like one example. Another example is there's a company called giftofcollege.com, which allows people to give gifts towards a 529 college savings plan or to pay down student debt, and they also offer gift cards. So that was one way. But then, you know, some of the advice I got was, you know, kind of a bit more general, you know, picking a gift card that they will actually use. And that sounds so obvious, but, you know, I've definitely been in the position where I've gotten a gift card for a store I don't shop at. So, you know, asking simple questions, you know, you can do it kind of covertly to find out where people shop at. Or alternatively, you know, it's another way of avoiding the issue of someone not using the gift card you give them is to give it to, you know, a very general store. You know, it may seem, you know, less fancy to give, you know, a Walmart gift card or an Amazon gift card, but there's a much greater chance that that will actually get used since, you know, they can pretty much buy anything from a store like that. Whereas, you know, if you give them, you know, if you give your girlfriend a Sephora gift card, well, maybe that's not where she likes to shop for makeup. So, you know, you don't want to find yourself giving a card that you know is just going to get hidden away in a drawer and go unused.
Yeah, let me ask you a question, Jacob. This came to my mind, and it's not typically how I think about receiving a gift. But is there a secondary market for gift cards? Like, could you trade your gift card for cash, but for a lesser amount?
Yes, so there are a number of secondary gift card resale websites. There's one called Gift Card Granny, one's called Raise, Card Pool, Card Cash. There's any number of them. And, you know, generally you have to sell cards at a slight discount to be able to sell them, which makes sense. But, you know, certain types of cards are more popular than others. Generally speaking, gift cards for electronic stores or tech companies see the smallest discounts, only 3% discounts on average. And Wallet Hub study found that Walmart gift cards have the highest resale value, followed by Apple gift cards, Red Lobster, and Whole Foods. So,
wow.
You know, think of, you know, kind of tech places or kind of popular retailers. Those will have you'll be able to sell them for a higher value. On the flip side, you don't want to necessarily get a gift card for, you know, a flowers shop like 1-800-Flowers or something like that. And generally, you know, Red Lobster is kind of the exception. Generally, restaurants aren't the best gift cards to give, and those sell at larger discounts. So that's good if you're buying the gift card, but if you're the one trying to offload it, then you want to avoid those and maybe keep that in mind when you're giving people gift cards. Give them ones that they can, you know, sell relatively easily if they need to, if it's not a store that they like.
Yeah. No, I don't mean to suggest that it's not a good gift, because I think it is a good gift. And I know that to your earlier point, if you can get something for like a Macy's, which is like a general store, you can buy different types of things. That's actually really great. And I think that's great sage advice. Do you have any idea about how, you know, kind of wrapping up the segment, do you have any idea about how long most gift cards last? Because some of them do expire. They don't last forever, I think, as you intimated.
So they generally need to last for around, I think it's 5 years. So yeah, there was a law that went into effect a few years ago that said that gift cards cannot expire until 5 years after they're initially purchased. But that being said, certain types of gift cards may come with fees, especially, Visa gift cards and, American Express gift cards, those types of gift cards, so ones not associated with a specific store. Those often will have inactivity fees, which can, reduce the amount on the card. So that's also something to keep in mind. You want to give a card that will be used relatively quickly, not one that's going to sit on a shelf, because if it sits on a shelf, it can expire or it can see its amount reduced. And one way to also avoid someone losing their gift card, because if it's a physical gift card, that's the equivalent of cash, is to give them a digital one. Again, it's not as fancy, a printout of a receipt for a digital gift card. Maybe might not be as nice to put in, a greeting card or something like that. But if you email your friends or loved ones digital gift cards, they'll have a that to check back in on through their email, so it won't go lost, which is another important thing to consider.
Very good. Well, obviously, perfect timing because people are out there shopping for family, and this is all good insight. Always great to talk with you, Jacob. Please give Allie our best, and we look forward to talking to you
I
both.
shall.
Talk to you both next week. Have a great weekend,
Yeah.
and have fun.
Sounds good. Same to you.
Take care, bud. Bye.
Bye.
Welcome back, everyone. And now it's time for our Legal Eagles segment. And the Eagles have flown and landed here on the podcast. We're joined today by Groom Law Group's David Levine and Kevin Walsh. Guys, how are you today?
We're doing well, Jeff. Thanks for having us on. It's always great being on.
It's always a pleasure with having you guys on. So many positive reviews for your appearance and what you're talking about each and every week. You're informing so many people. And also, I want to give you some kudos. You guys were also great. This week we released the segment we recorded last month, kind of previewing the midterm elections, and that also got great rave reviews, and you guys are so photogenic. You guys need to do more TV.
I mean, thanks. It's easier to be a good guest when you've got a great host.
This is like the mutual admiration society, right, David?
Hey, I'm not going there. I'm staying out of this discussion.
Okay, so let's kick things off. We've got a lot of things this week. I know, David, you wanted to talk about these new hardship withdrawal regulations.
Yes, I do, Jeff. To give it really simply, many of you who are plan sponsors have probably been hearing about new rules about what you can allow for a hardship that address many things, whether or not you need to take a loan from the plan before you take a hardship, what sources of money are available, and whether you need to suspend people's regular contributions to the plan when they're on hardship. For years, those have been part of the regular rules, and due to legislation in 2018, that changed. And the IRS in November came out with guidance that tells us how to put out these rules. But as many of us know, the implementation of rules can be a challenge because record keepers have to update their systems and service providers have to help their clients through deciding, if anything, what they're going to do for these changes. So it's a topsy-turvy time. So what's the takeaway right now on hardships? The takeaway is each record keeper is taking a slightly different approach because, as I said, making your computer systems line up and all your sources and your buckets fit together is complex, and they don't want to make a mistake. So some may have some availability for some of these changes, and some may say we're only doing X or Y. So as a plan sponsor, it's important to understand what your provider can do for you right now and what your options are, if any. Also, there's a whole discussion of what do you want to do if there are options, if you do want to eliminate the requirement that people take a plan loan. Many people are sort of just going with their provider defaults, but there are some who sort of are saying, well, we think that we don't want people taking more hardships, so they're not implementing some of the optional features that make it easier to take hardships. Is there a right answer here? No. But the key is to think about, from a systems standpoint and your payroll systems, as well as your record keeper, what fits together, as well as what's sort of the ethos of your plan? What do you want it to be? And then you get into service agreement amendments as needed and more likely plan amendments. And if you're on a pre-approved plan, your provider will probably do it. If you're on an individually designed plan, something to think about as you head into 2019, but not to rush to right now. Kevin, you want – go ahead, Jeff.
Well, I was going to say great points. And I think as a reformed record keeper and current consultant advisor, you know, I think my takeaway – one of my takeaways from what you're saying, David, is allow enough time and then – you know, these record keepers, not every record keeping system is the same across every record keeper. And even if they're using the same base record keeping system, they might have different enhancements that they've made to their system that have to be taken into account. All of these systems have to be updated, and they're not just, it's not like a switch is flipped tomorrow if you tell them today. There is, you know, usually 30, 60, 90 days towards implementation. And then you've got, all, as you implement, intimated, you've got paperwork that has to be updated, plan documents, summary plan descriptions, online tools, etc. So really good points by you. And I think as you always advocate here on the podcast and to your clients, it's always a thoughtful, determinant process. Sorry to interrupt, David. Kevin, I know you, David was going to pitch it to you to talk about our friends in Europe and the GDPR.
Thanks, Jeff. So I'm talking this week about data privacy and cybersecurity because this is a topic that, while it's been somewhat hot in America, is totally on fire in Europe, and it's likely to continue heating up over here. So for those of you who don't know, GDPR, it's this data privacy and cybersecurity directive that came out of the European Union, and it is fairly prescriptive about when data can be gathered and used and how it can be used. And one of the primary concerns that U.S. benefit plans, U.S. benefit plan service providers, and others have had is, well, I'm a U.S. plan or I'm a U.S. service provider. Does GDPR apply to me? And while the answer to this is still not certain, Europe issued some helpful guidance in November in the form of draft guidelines on the territorial scope of the GDPR. Now, I'm not going to read to you what it says because one of the great things about European regulation and guidance drafting is that it is fairly dense. But there's a couple of key takeaways from this. And one is that if you're established in the European Union, so if you're a company that's based in the European Union, if you have affiliates in the European Union, if you have a registered agent in the European Union, or if you kind of run a website in the European Union that has targeted specific European countries, so you accept payments in euros, you have an easy click here in euros, you're not just in English, but you're in Dutch, it's more likely that the European Union would think that you're established in the European Union. If you're an American benefit plan or you're an American company and you happen to have a few people visiting Europe, traveling to Europe, the guidance makes it seem less likely that you're going to be viewed as being established in the European Union. So kind of the establishment prong is one of the ways that you can get sucked into GDPR. And it would appear that for American benefit plans, if this guidance is finalized, and if with a little bit more helpful clarification, that American benefit plans would generally not satisfy that prong. So the other way that you can really get covered by GDPR, and this is one that we've been focused on for a while, is if you're targeting individuals in the European Union. And targeting or monitoring, prong one is if you're trying to sell a good or service to an individual in the EU. The second prong is if you're trying to monitor someone within the EU. And for benefit plans, there was a big fear that the offering of employee benefits would be considered an offering of a good and service. And while it's not entirely clear, there's an example in the draft guidelines, example 9, that talks about how when a company is providing payroll to its employees, that's not the offering of a good and service. So while we're still not all the way to saying U.S. plans don't have to worry about this or U.S. service providers don't have to worry about this, there's helpful guidance that's coming out that indicates that there's efforts being made either by U.S. companies working over there or just by the European Union itself to recognize that it's got to develop a workable framework. And these guidelines, while they don't get us all the way there, signal that we're moving in that direction.
Very interesting. Thanks, Kevin. You know, this is the gift that keeps on giving, I guess, if you're really into data and data privacy. I don't see this issue. Guys, I don't see this issue going away at all.
Well, given the news of the last week, Jeff, and things here in the United States, there's been more discussion every day about legislation in D.C. But that's something we'll talk about in 2019.
Guys, always a pleasure. Wishing you a very happy weekend, and we'll talk to you very soon.
Thanks, Jeff.
Bye-bye. That wraps up another great episode of the Weekly Pulse. Special thanks to Angela Antonelli from the Georgetown Center for Retirement Policy Initiatives for sharing her insight and a look into what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around this country with respect to retirement and retirement policy. Thank you to you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it, and we look forward to having you back next week. So check us out. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you soon.